take yourself hypnotism. Self-hypnotism is merely putting oneself to sleep. The idea is that at certain levels of your being, you are already asleep, and sleep there means, as far as the individual is concerned, a state of unconsciousness to the individual. But at that level there may be, and certainly it is so under certain conditions, types of consciousness quite different from the waking. We know that hypnotism is derived from the Greek word for sleep, and if we hypnotize another human being other than ourselves, or an animal, what we do is put out of commission for the time being the conscious, egoic, critical faculties. So in this sense, when we are considering hypnotism in its usual usage, it is a negative condition where the person is quite passive to suggestions. You know that you have three parts in your being, and you know also that the head contains three parts, the back part corresponding with the belly centers and the middle part of the chest, and the front part corresponding with itself, with the head properly. And it's this front part that is put out of commission by hypnotic procedure. And the person's functions are really decreased. He has less control, not more control. So that under hypnotic influence, a person is less of a man than he was before he was hypnotized. Whereas in contemplation, the exact opposite holds. In contemplation, you are, if it's a true contemplation, in control of your own consciousness. You remember we said that we have a preliminary condition of concentration of mental energy, and then a discursive process of meditation about the object when we exhaust its significance, and then the state where the mind goes into complete identification with the object without discursiveness but in full consciousness. And it's this non-discursive holding of the mind in identity with the object that is called contemplation. Now we've said before that all opposites are very, very closely related, that in a certain sense the opposites have an identity. And so in a certain sense hypnotism and contemplation are exactly opposite to each other, because in contemplation the person is passive to the object and is completely identified with it, and in hypnotism he is also completely passive to the object and is identified with it. But in the case of the hypnotic process, the putting out of action of the critical faculties invalidates it as a pure positive state, whereas in contemplation you haven't paralyzed your critical faculties, you have lifted them to another level whereby you transcend the ordinary states of mental activity. If we consider the examples very carefully, one of the easiest animals to hypnotize is a rabbit. We can put a rabbit down and immediately just put it down in a certain position and stroke it, and it will immediately be hypnotized. That is to say, it cannot get up and it will stay down there indefinitely. Now, it has been imposed upon by us. We have a technique to impose on the rabbit. The rabbit has no reflexive power of its own, so it cannot do this trick on itself. If we take the same idea and apply it to a human being, because a human being is more complicated than a rabbit, the technique of producing this monoideistic state is slightly more complex, but in principle it's the same. We fix the mind, the field consciousness, around an object,
chair, here's your phone.
One person hypnotizes another. In effect, the hypnotized person is reduced to the level of that rabbit. He can be made to do all sorts of quite stupid things down to the level of a rabbit, simply because his definable human qualities, his rationality and reflexiveness, have been put out of commission. So as we said before, he's less of a human being hypnotized than he is otherwise. If a man tries to hypnotize himself, either he's going to use the term hypnotism in the wrong sense, or he's going to reduce himself to the level of a rabbit. One of the early experimenters, Bram, in hypnotism, accidentally did this on himself. He was trying an experiment with some rotating mirrors, and he was watching them to see the effect on himself. And then he found many hours later that he was still there. What had gone on, he didn't know. And on another occasion, a patient who had this device set before him, and he was told to look at it, and he went into a similar state to the rabbit and stayed there for a few hours. Now, if a person is not broken out of such a state by an external stimulus, they would stay in it until some internal stimulus disrupted the condition. It would have to be something painful, perhaps becoming very, very hungry. The facts of hypnotic possibilities show that it's possible to reduce yourself to a non-reflexive level and receive no benefit whatever. You can, if you like, stare at a very bright object, and in the staring at that bright object you can tire the optic nerves. This is a chief mechanical method of hypnotizing a human being, to tire the optic nerve, and then the mind has no stimulus to keep it working, and it may be seized by the bright light and held in that state, so that there's nothing in the consciousness whatever other than an awareness of a bright light without a reflexive awareness that he is aware that there's a bright light. If he were aware that he was aware, then he would be still human and not hypnotized. So we can say that hypnosis is a lower level, whether induced by another person or by oneself, simply because it destroys this capacity for reflexive, self-conscious control. Some books, quite popular books on hypnosis and auto-hypnosis, recommend a method of giving oneself post-hypnotic suggestion. That is to say, you are supposed to receive a suggestion which, given in a hypnotized state, will result in an action later on. It is recommended to do this in order to get physical health or success. The fundamental theory is that you have an unconscious mind, and that the unconscious mind cannot refuse a suggestion. And the thing that refuses a suggestion is your critical faculty, your rational faculty. So if the rational faculty is put out of commission, any suggestion thrown into the unconscious mind will result in the unconscious releasing forces to try to establish the significance of that suggestion. It has been said by public hypnotists that you cannot make a person do something against his better nature. Well, in fact, that is just a statement for public consumption, because you can make a person do anything whatever if you remove this critical interferer, limiter. And the way it is done is simply to make the thing look acceptable, which is quite easy with the appropriate suggestive formula. Hypnotism, then, is really a production of a lower level than the human level, whether it's done on you by another person or by yourself. It may have some justification under extreme conditions or under experimental conditions. But as a general practice, it is not to be recommended because it reduces you to a lower than human level. If you remember, we said that if the field, that is your feeling awareness, is presented with an idea, it automatically precipitates on it. Now, if we say that the undefined feeling substance of a human being or of the whole universe is presented with an idea, it will always orientate itself to the idea, simply because it is seeking manifestation. The old statement, every spirit seeks a body. The Jakob Boehmer, the German mystic, says that the magician works by giving a lift to the soul of nature, and then nature executes. Now, in medieval times, they used to define the animus dei, the spirit of God, or the soul of God, and the animus, or anima, female, mundi. Now, the soul of the world was considered to be an impersonal, that is, a non-defined field of sentiency. And when it is started in reaction by the presentation of an idea, it will then orientate to it without any reflexive control and must work towards the projection of that thing, no matter how foolish the initiating idea. So therefore it is said that nature, left alone, always fails. This is a funny thing to say. The soul of nature responds to every stimulus by trying to bring it to be. You know, in your own self, that there's as much energy behind a fearful, negative state as there is behind a positive one. So there's no discriminating power whatever in your fundamental feeling, which is identical with the soul of the world. When it is said the Spirit of God, that is the initiating power which imparts the first motion to the feeling substance of the universe. In this sense, we can say that the soul of the world is always hypnotized. That is to say, it is always deprived of reflexive possibilities and is always passive to the being that can throw in an initiating idea. So, in this sense, the soul of the world, the feeling substratum of all the beings in the universe, is in a perpetual state of hypnosis and passivity, waiting for a stimulus. Whereas in the case of the spirit personalized, that is reflexively formed consciously, it is no longer passive, it is highly active, and it alone has the power to impart a stimulus to the universal substance, or to the human substance, the unconscious of an individual human being, and thereby to produce a result. Now, if we want to practice what is signified by self-hypnosis, we would have to keep one part of ourselves active, non-hypnotized, to give the other part of ourselves the necessary suggestion so that it would pass into passivity. This means that we would have to divide ourselves into two parts, a subjective and objective part. And therefore, the operator could not be hypnotized. So in the statement self-hypnosis is a contradiction. Self-half-hypnosis would be more like it. Now, there is a state between sleeping and waking, between deep sleep and waking, that we call the dream state. And before you lose consciousness in the dream, there is an intermediary state between ordinary waking daily consciousness and the dreaming state. And in this state between dream and ordinary waking, there is the possibility of acting upon the dreaming substance like the Spirit of God acts on the soul of the world. That is, like the operator in a hypnotic experiment operates on the passive subject. So when actually you are going to sleep at night, if you watch yourself very carefully and wait for this fantasy to begin to appear, at that moment, that part of yourself is already hypnotized by the fantasy. If you retain enough positivity in yourself, that means you don't fall to sleep, you don't pass into a dream fantasy, you can then, it is, you can produce a form which you consider worthy of putting into that substance, that sentiency substance, and deliberately put it in, and know that simply from the inherent nature of this sentiency substance, it must start modelling on that idea and try to substantiate it in the body. It means that the best time for working on your own body conditions, really, is in the state between waking and dreaming. You can't do it in the state between dreaming and deep sleep. So you have to do it between waking and dreaming. And there are two main times when you can do it: before going to sleep at night and on waking up in the morning. This is the exercise we referred to once as the rocking backwards and forwards. Before you're going to sleep at night, you deliberately try to stop yourself becoming unconscious or enveloped by the fantasy, and you retain the point of positivity, and you deliberately make that point of positivity definable in certain positive cosmic forms that are going to be useful to you. When you wake up in the morning, the first thing to do is not to wake up, but to turn the mind back immediately upon itself and say, what was I dreaming about? And when you can drive yourself back into the dream without falling asleep again, which usually happens, then again you have this point of greatest interference. But at night, before you go to sleep, the enemy is being too wakeful. And in the morning, on waking up, the enemy is the danger of falling back to sleep and finding you're not at work. It depends how much time you've got. Quite a few people find that if they do this morning exercise, they don't go to work. Because in searching back, they go to sleep again and wake up a few hours later. This is a thing that happens very, very often until you get used to this balance. So, in the case of self-hypnotism, really, the hypnotizing of oneself, if we mean other than half-hypnotizing, would be a bad thing. It's equivalent to simple fascination, where the whole organism is held statically with the, say, a light stimulus as its sole content. So we would rule it out, unless by that we mean half-hypnotism. We can divide ourselves into two aspects, can't we? The feeling, which is undefined, and our ideational processes, which are defined. The active side of us is the side that reflects and keeps saying, I know that I know. This is the form that I know, and I know that I know it. You must get this formula going, and never allow that formula to become merely a formula to the point of mechanical repetition, because then it becomes simply a little machine that goes down, and you can fall asleep again. The object is to make it significant. And that active part of yourself is related to the rational part, and the rational is the part that controls objectivity. Whereas the feeling side of your nature is not objective, it's subjective, and it is the part that receives the suggestions from the conscious, rational part of your mind. Now, in the case of contemplation, we have to raise ourselves up to a certain level consciously. The big enemy of contemplation is going to sleep again. We set up an object, and the object must be worthy of our prolonged attention, otherwise we won't attend to it. So we take a cosmic fact of terrific significance. Supposing we say, as we've done before, that is the limit of the first term, the macrocosmic circumscription, and all inside there, represented by the white paper, is sentiency substance. It is that that is the unconscious, the collective unconscious of Carl Jung, the unconscious responsive substance of the soul of the world. Now, we call this out here spirit because it has necessarily to be defined as possessing powers of initiation in order to produce this circumscription. So that circumscription here is already a form. But if it's just a simple big rotation with no internal sub-rotations, then there is no spirit inside that world cell, it's just soul. But if the spirit from outside also goes inside, it again defines. Every definition is a circumscribed limit. And the act of putting in these definitions is positive. And we see here that what is positive is always a negation. We remember, to posit is to put, to sit, power, to post sit. The po means power. See it in the word power. It's the same PO in poet. It's the same PO in le pouvoir. Wherever you see that PO, it refers to the positing of a zone of activity. So, positivity is po sit. This sitting is the locating of power. This can only be done by rotating. But in the act of doing so, it has circumscribed or limited a zone. And we say of limitation, it is a negative. So the posit always posits a neg. What is being posited is a negation. This is again the dialectical law. You find a lot of modern books of New Thought and so on that say you should never affirm a negative. It is a bad thing. And yet every value that we know of consists in a definition, which is a circumscription, a limitation, or a negation of another field. The whole of the sciences are defined separately from each other in order to clarify the contents, so that the mechanistic behaviorist view of the mental activities of a human being and the psychological view are kept different by using certain terms differently. And always a term negates, that is, it excludes as well as includes. So we always posit a negation. But if we know this fact, we know what we are positing and why. This universe here, the macrocosmos, this universe was posited by God. God here is the Spirit. Now, it says he so loved the world. That means to say that this Spirit, with all this rubbed out, considers that it has not reached the term of manifestation of its own potentialities. Now, a being that has potentialities and doesn't actualize them always feels full of possibilities. We call it tumescence. And those possibilities will be continuously tending to manifest. So we know that in the Spirit there is a tendency to create, to produce substantialized versions of its potentialities. So here is the world as a zone of sentiency, posited as a negation of the absolute, and made so because it fulfills certain of the potentialities of spirit. Now you remember we once said about this spirit, it is in the Hebrew Kabbalah, it is called Ein Sof, which is a negation. It means the not. But we said that the not doesn't mean what people think it means. This is a negative state simply because it has refused to negate itself. It has refused to posit. But in the act of positing, what it posits is a negation. And two negatives make a positive. So if we first put a negation down, that is a limit, and then rub it out, we have done two negatives. First we posit a negative, and then we rub the negative out, that's two negatives. So we then have the negation of the negation, which is the supreme positive. So we say that spirit is absolutely positive, that is to say it's the absolute potential of all possibilities, or pos again, is this posit. The ability to posit is ability. The ability refers to its particularity. So spirit is an absolute positive, and it posits its first negation in order to express a particular potentiality separate from some other potentialities. Then it comes inside again and makes another negation, which is again a positive statement of a limit. And it keeps doing this within itself, and wherever it makes a turn, it makes a positing of a being that is negated. We are positive beings, which is the same thing as saying that we are negative beings. our negativity as human beings consists entirely in our positivity as being finite and preferring to be so. This dialectical way of thinking is absolutely necessary, and you can't repeat it too often to get to understand precisely what it means to negate in positing and to posit by negation. It gives you the power to control your own feeling responses later in the act that people are supposed to be doing when they're practicing auto-hypnosis. Spirit has infinite possibilities, but those infinite possibilities, if they are not circumscribed, are chaotic. So it posits negations in order to separate out all its potentials so that each one can stand on its own in its pure form. And it is the ultimate purpose of this spirit, which is fundamentally personal, because it is pirasana, that is, it functions by formulations of intelligence. Its ultimate aim is to make inside here some individuated beings with exactly the same powers that it has, absolutely, only here, relatively. This is really what the New Testament is about, and what the Old Testament prophesies. When the New Testament talks about the one who is born in Christ is released from sin, sin equals separation. It's released from the idea that that little circle is on its own and not related to this one or this one. Inside there, again, there's this sentiency substance, and it is the feeling substance, the sentiency, that constitutes, because it is not formed, the link factor, the continuity principle. So it is through the feeling that we become conscious of the transcendence of form. And there again, there are two possibilities. We can become aware of feeling absolutely and lose our form. And we don't want to do that. We want to have the best of both worlds, the best of the feeling world and the best of the ideational world. The object is to make every human individual so aware of its own origin, like this, so that it becomes conscious of identical powers with this absolute spirit. The way to do so lies through proper definition in the first instance, because that releases you from improper definition and its effects, and then by training in sensitivity in the feeling, so that you can simultaneously feel and define what you feel. In the ordinary state of hypnosis, you feel and you cannot actively define. In the half state of hypnosis we talked about, where you hypnotize half of you, the feeling half, and at the same time retain your rational control, then you can indulge in a kind of mediumistic activity and retain complete critical control of the process. So, when we are contemplating, we take an object worthy of our attention, and the only object really worthy of our attention is the supreme object. The object is to consider the whole concept of circumscription, of limitation, of power, and to meditate on the reason why that occurs. And having discovered why it occurs, the mechanics of how it occurs, it then becomes possible for us to work upon ourselves to eliminate the lines that have been drawn unnecessarily. There are certain necessary forms of manifestation and certain unnecessary ones that impede the action of the necessary ones. Now, it is said that God is love, and if we care to think about that within our definition as a power working for the development of the potentialities of being, and not to confuse it with the usual usage of the word, then it becomes obvious that our highest concept involves remembering that definition. We are trying to contact the source power from which we came. not an alien power. It is the very source of our own being, which formulated our own being and devised our physical organs and maintains them, and if we behave ourselves, maintains them thoroughly, and if we don't, something goes wrong from our end, not from its end. In considering this as the supreme object and bringing ourselves by definitional exercise into full awareness of what it means, we contemplate the soul of the world and the spirit animating that soul, and remember that we ourselves are kept in being by it now, not that it acted at some time past, but that it acts now to maintain the universe. If that power stopped operating for one moment, the whole universe would disintegrate. The universe is a structure of rotating powers. If that power, the primary power, just stopped the big rotation, then every nebulous system, the solar system and all the planets and everything on it would immediately crumble, because they're all dependent on that primary field. It is this super field that determines all the behavior of the processes of evolution inside the wheel, right up to the point where a man becomes reflexively self-conscious. We said before that nature, unaided, fails. What is meant by that initiation statement is, nature, unaided, will never reach reflexive self-consciousness. It means that if we define this natura as the serpent with tail in mouth, it is a self-stimulating system, a large system, and it produces within itself all these little things which respond as a whole. And at the level at which this world soul is driving humanity, we see that fact that makes people often depressed, that nature is very careful about the type and very careless about the individual. The human race has to survive, says the world soul, because ultimately within the human race reflexive self-conscious beings are produced. But as that is the aim, to produce those beings, then it has no regard whatever for any beings, although they're called humans, who are below the level of reflexive self-consciousness. This is why we say that a man that reaches a certain level, he then begins to have a destiny, instead of simply suffer from fate. Fate is what is imposed on him from outside. Destiny is where you are going consciously from inside. So this world soul, this self-stimulating system, is only concerned to maintain its wholeness. It isn't concerned to save particular individuals. So the herring lays innumerable eggs, and most of them are scoffed by other fish in the sea. It has no regard for the individual. Now, in the case of human beings, if an individual becomes aware of this, first as a conceptual possibility, and then he works upon it to see its inherent logic, at the point where he sees its inherent logic, then he begins to put his will into it. And he won't do that until it begins to appear to him to be possibly true. This is why the statement is made, know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. If you see that a thing is inherently possible, logically likely, then your will begins to flow into it. Remember, the will was the initiation of the feeling. If you throw rubbish at somebody and say 2 and 2 is 5.5, there's an automatic rejection of it. And a philosophy based on that would not be seriously examined. And if you make a logical statement such that it becomes self-evident, then the feeling mobilizes itself on it. The will follows the form. So when we become aware of the process, and these human beings who are working towards that reflexive, self-conscious awareness of the purpose of spirit, and who conceive themselves as its vehicles, these people are called the elect. In the New Testament it says, those now calling themselves the Jews are not the Jews, because really the term due means the mysterious perfection of the God in the man reflecting the man in the God. It's a process whereby when a man contemplates the real meaning of this symbol, it is not that man contemplating it, but it is the universal contemplating itself through the man. Now it's quite obvious that if you meditate on the source diagram and remember that you derive from your source, because you do not get anything out of the basket other than what's put into it, when you are actually meditating upon your own source, it is your source which is meditating upon itself. We're discussing it at the moment. So at the precise moment where you can contemplate the source, it is the source in self-contemplation. Now this is the most important part about contemplation. The activities of spirit are always conducing, in the act called love, namely the development of potentials, to produce diverse actualizations of its infinite possibilities. And wherever it finds a vehicle responsive enough to serve as a reflecting point, at that moment, it does not differentiate between its purpose and the individual purpose, because they're identical. It therefore is prepared to preserve that individual vehicle for its purpose, so that from the point of view of the individual, self-preservation of the individual involves conscious reflection of the purpose of spirit, because spirit will then preserve that being for the term that spirit designs. And it is quite useless of an individual to try to prolong individual existence beyond the point where it is useful to spirit. But if he stops fighting against spirit, his existence will be of longer duration and stronger and better quality than it would otherwise be. So if we draw a line right through this now, we won't close this end. There's infinite possibility going in here and out. This is the individual man who is aware that the forces of his own thought have nothing new in them, because those thoughts were here, always, eternally, as forms. Spirit means initiative form. They involve into the man as he meditates upon it. At the point where he becomes aware of its origin, it is that origin become aware in that man, and he allows the return flow. If the man tries to hang on to the power that he feels, he's then trying to preserve his life, and he will lose it. And if he's prepared to lose it as an individual, more comes in. He who tries to preserve his life will lose it. You can see why, because if you try to hang on in the finite sense, you've immediately limited your capacity. Whereas if you try to say, all right, it's better to give than to receive, freely have I received, freely give, throw it out. The more you can throw out at any level, the more must come in to replace it. And the more careful you become about energy expenditure, the less will be given to you. By this simple law, simply because the creative process itself is concerned to make itself vehicles that can consciously reflect their origin and continuously redistribute the energies coming to it. This spirit has no regard for a thing that tries to rotate on its own and doesn't want help from God and doesn't want to give help to any other being. That being becomes progressively smaller, and by its own definition of itself, it is circumscribing its energies and giving rise to specific types of faulty function. Each faulty function arises from a primary error, which comes into being as a possibility of the first definition. You could say the first error of all is to postulate that that is as valid as the undefined. The Luciferian act of saying a finite can be made to absorb infinity, and then trying to pile the infinity into the finite and hold it. This is what produces the tumescent state But after a certain number of revolutions of force, it flies out again and produces another being. So when we contemplate, that is, we keep ourselves in the same time with, that's contemplation, we lay ourselves in the same time with that thing, so that every beat, the frequencies of that being, is echoed in our own substance, so that whatever happens in it happens in us. That is contemplation. So when we bring ourselves by conscious reflection upon the real meaning of spirit and soul, at that moment we vibrate exactly in unison with it. And it is at that point that we are not different. It's that point to which Christ refers when he said, I and my Father are one. Whereas when he said, my Father is greater than I, this was the I he referred to, and that was the Father. So my Father is greater than I, and yet, as far as this frequency is concerned, the resonance being identical, they are one, one functionally. But thinking about the dynamic relations and the mechanical implications, all the ambiguous statements in the Bible become immediate sense. There is no rubbish in the Bible at all. It's all concerned with this dialectical relation and the definition of this, and how definition produces function, and how potential function here has produced the definition. So now we can say that all the beings inside here who are rotating and believing themselves to be separate are hypnotized. That is to say, they are asleep. There's another question here about what good yet meant. We'll lead on to this now. It is said that the waking state of man is really the state when he's most asleep. If by waking state we mean the state of a man when he is, during the day, walking about, responding to stimuli to the five senses. He's really most asleep when he's responding to stimuli from the five senses. In other words, he's what the Americans would call a jerk at that level, a knee jerk, a reflex. He's a very simple reflex. A force hits him, a response comes out, and he's no idea why it came out or whether it need have come out. He just comes out. And it's this conditioned reflex man who is the man that's really asleep. And yet that is the man that is said to be awake. As long as he goes to work at a certain time, his boss defines him as awake. And the boss, really, if he's a good boss, knows that if he were really to wake up, he wouldn't be there. He'd have another firm with some other wakeful people of the same order. You see? So, when we're considering this question of a person defining himself, we must be very careful about this. As you define yourself, so you are. As a man thinks in his heart, so is he. Thinks, formulates, in his heart, that means in his feeling, so is he. A man who defines himself as possessed of certain limitations is hypnotizing himself. And his own feeling level is responding to his definition and malfunctioning according to the definition of humans. So a person that says, oh, I couldn't do that, is really making himself incapable of doing it, whatever it is. He is defining a limitation. He's positing a negation of his own being. So, the man who contemplates his own character as already formulated irretrievably is killing himself, and he is already hypnotized. We know that really he's not self-hypnotized, because he has been conditioned by tradition, by education, by the example of other people. So the people that we know that are walking about in their millions are hypnotized by other forces, but they're not even, in general, personal forces that are hypnotizing him, because the chief influences at work are other sleeping people. That is to say, the parents, the educators, and so on, who are all reflexively, in the sense of a reflex of the nerves, not consciously, they are producing this reflex action, and that is acting upon the child, and the child is becoming a conditioned reflex system too. So the dead are very, very busy burying the dead. Remember that when one man says to Christ, "Let me first bury my father, and then I'll follow you," and he says, "Let the dead bury their dead." It is significant that the fellow wants to bury his father, that is, the source of his own deadness. And therefore the psychologically apt reply that Christ gives is, "Let your dead father, the fellow who made you dead in the first place, let him bury himself. He's already buried you by the mere fact that you want to go back and bury him." Whereas, if he is now merely a body, the undertaker will take care of him and get his money off the state, if you don't mind being talked about. So, always in this definition, the very thing by which we fall, we may rise. People fall by definition, imposed upon them by tradition, to other dead people, and they rise again by redefinition of their real situation. What we have to do is redefine ourselves. Instead of defining ourselves as social entities with a materialistic welfare state as our ideal, we define ourselves as having our being in our source now, that what intelligence we have is simply the source intelligence appearing in us, that it is no respecter of persons, in the sense that any person who tries to oppose it will be ridden through, and nevertheless personality, used reflexively to meditate on its source, is simply source personality reflecting on itself in that being. So if we move on then to this second point, it's about the connection between the centers and the batteries in Gurdjieff's system and the yoga chakras. Well, we said before that if there is a definition, there is a limitation. If we don't make a limitation, we haven't got a battery. There's no one calling this thing a battery out here, because the letter B says that we must be circumscribed. A battery is a storage house for energies. It's really a place where little impulses are stored up. You could call it a beatery, if you like, where things are going like that. And unless you have a finite zone, you haven't got a battery. Let's take a human being now. He has three divisions here. Each one has its own circumscription, and there's the integrating rod between them. Because there is a limit, and there is energy in it which may come out, then it is a battery. So now we have three centers here, and each zone which takes its orders from that center may be considered, insofar as it contains energy, as a battery. We know that we have a funny phenomenon called second wind when we run. We run for a certain extent and we get terrible pain. If we force ourselves willfully to run through it, it'll go away, then we can run a lot longer. We may get another one after a long run. If we force ourselves through that, then we can run a lot longer again. And we come to another one. If we try to force ourselves through that, we usually die. The first one is quite bad enough to force yourself to. The second one, if you bother to run that far, is considerably more painful. And this phenomenon of second wind is tremendously important, because it says that we have different energy levels. Now let's take a man who stored all his energy in the belly department, and he didn't waste any in foolish emotional relations with other beings or in thinking about philosophers or anything. He just put all the food he'd got down there and kept his energy circulating, and they'd pile in and they would manifest by sexual emissions periodically. He would be a battery charging up, and then there'd be a release of energy. Prior to that release, the beat inside would be terrific. Actually, Negroes refer to this state before sexual activity becomes very much manifested as a beat. They can feel the rhythm of it underneath. Here then would be a battery of tremendous potential, because the sexual energies are quite obviously related immediately to the generative forces of the universe itself. An individual is utilized by that force. Sexual energy in people in general is not individualized. It runs through individuals, utilizes them, has no regard for them, puts them into strange alliances, and then leaves them to solve the relations. It is a tremendously powerful thing, and non-individuated. And it is no respecter of persons. It's the one that we would equate with God the Father, theologically. Now, there's another one here, the emotional one. You can actually store emotional energies. You do this every time you don't like somebody and don't say so. Store it up. Or do like somebody and don't say so. The fundamental thing is that whatever you feel like expressing, you don't. And then the energy in that centre piles up and up and up. But the quality of the energy in this centre isn't the same as that. You can hear this energy centre with a peculiar beat in it. Say, Judy Garland has it in the voice. There's a peculiar emotional beat that shows she's heading towards emotional storms and breakdowns all the time. You can hear it in quite a few of the better taught singers. And it's caused by a discharge in two directions at once, yes and no. If we put the yes in there and the no there, and contemplate I like it and I don't like it, of the same object at the same moment, there arises this emotional beat in the voice. And the energies there have a different function from these. These are energies driving down and positing onto the earth. These are energies going like this, spreading into universal compassion. And up here in the head, the same thing is happening. All the ideas that you get that you don't express pile up and up and up inside, so you have a battery of ideas. And they work at three different frequencies. Now, we said before that we can cut them all into two halves, and that the higher mentality and the lower mentality differed because the higher one was fed from above on our six-pointed star, and the lower one was fed through the five senses. The frequency of the lower mind is considerably slower than the one of the higher mind, and the emotions derived from sense world contacts are considerably lower than the compassion motives derived from contemplating the real significance of the relation soul and spirit absolute. So we have these batteries in ourselves, and the batteries contain all the energies that we have not yet expressed, and they're continuously being built up. We live inside a field, and if we like to think of our edges as being partially insulating material, and yet there's a continuous drift into us, then a build-up occurs on the inside which demands expression in action. The reason is that the absolute spirit is determined to manifest formally. Itself is beyond all definition, but whenever there is a definition, it drifts through the walls of that container. Nature abhors the vacuum. It drifts through the walls of that container and then changes its frequency once it's inside the defined zone, and then it shoots out at another level, a lower level of action. And so the absolute spirit is continuously manifesting by penetrating through membranes, changing its frequency, and then actuating itself in the material world at the lowest level. You see that this has to do with the real meaning of the incarnation of Christ. Christ represents God and man, Son of God, Son of Man. He knows he comes from here, and he knows he's come to a historic line, Abrahamic and so on, and out to the house of David, all of which are necessary stages to the appearance in him of reflexive self-consciousness. Actually, if we take the names out of the Bible of all the linear predecessors in Christ's line and look at the meaning of those names in Hebrew, we find the exact definitional steps that we have to take in order to become reflexively self-conscious. Supposing we say of Abraham himself, He was called Ab Ram before he got the agent. Now, this Ram is Hebrew for high. It refers to this function coming in and making the high being, the first being. That Ab means the father. The Aleph in it means this energy. The B means this limitation. The R means the differentiation inside here. The M means the actual sentiency substance. So he represents our first big concept that we'll need before we go on and on through various descendants, Isaac and Jacob and so on, till we come to Double Vision David, this analytical boy and so on. Each name represents a function which leads inevitably towards reflexive self-consciousness. So after a certain number of generations, there appears a reflexively self-conscious man in whom spirit, by reason of the refinement of the vehicle, is able to reflect that it is spirit individually, absolutely. So although he operates as an individual, he operates universally. So he talks double talk all the time. Of myself I can do nothing, I can do all things. My Father has put all power into my hands without measure. My Father works, and I work. What I see the Father do in secret, that I do openly, and so on. If you take every statement he makes, it's all to do with this relation of the undefined personal and the definition of a limit of world sentiency inside which feeling is, which will receive the suggestions of the Father Spirit from outside. There's several questions here. I'll just carry on a little bit with the sentence we did here. We said that we have a thinking, feeling, and volitional centers. And we said that the relation between them implied here and here subsidiary centers. If we like to put the geometry, we put another circle here and another one here. And we said also that the top one here belongs to this original spirit, and the bottom one to which first positing the primary substance, the prima materia of the early philosophers, is represented down here. In Sanskrit, the name of this chakra is the Mula, the root chakra, Muladhara. It is that substance which is necessary as a prime vehicle of formulation. If we don't have a substance, we can't formulate. If we have, we can begin to formulate. That was a piece of paper. It is now a cone. It is still paper. Formulation is manipulation of a primary substance. The primary substance can be conceived as a first modal vibration, the intersections of all the vibrations in it being termed primary atoms. These are not to be equated with the atoms of sands, because they would be more likely to be electrons. But the smallest conceivable particles, all vibrating, are simply the intersection points of primary waves crossing each other. And the totality of all those intersection points in a zone is called the substance of that zone. So the substantialization of spirit is simply that the spirit vibrates, it is power, and its vibrations in their totality constitute for it the primary substance which it then acts upon, and by distortion models. We say distortion. Torsion is a twist, and distortion is two twists. So if we take this one is the big twist, the one the Tatters of Hermes is thrice twisted, and it's a reference to this process. This is the first twist, or law, Torah, and the dis twist is when we go like this. That's already a distortion. Here's another distortion. And here's another distortion, and here's another, and so on. continuous distortion, productions of dualities within the main torsion, produce the plural universe. But always the same process exactly is going on. There is first of all power, which itself is intelligent, and it has potentials of infinite formulations. To bring these into separate being, it has to produce substance. This it does by vibration. Then it spins the resultants, the creator, the creator, creator, means this mixing bowl. It spins all these particles, and the spinning system of particles is in the substantial prime state of the material world. Then by continuous applications of energies which are infinite, from outside penetrating, it continuously rearranges the particles, which are the wave intersections, within this sphere and produces the universe we know. And it never has a new way of doing it. It is always the same way. There is always there a receptive field of sentiency, and then an impact initiative will with a certain form. The feeling seizes on it, it turbulates and is kept in being by its rotation. So that every value whatever that you can conceive starts as a know thing out here, comes in, touches sentience in itself, and then turbulates. And this turning establishes as a being. And every establishment is for a specific function. And if the interest of a being in its own center is exhausted, then if it is a finite being, it has the capacity to down tools. It becomes uninterested. And when it becomes uninterested, it stops throwing energy out. And when it stops throwing energy out, no energy comes in and the being begins to shrink. You note an actual loss of physical size in most human beings when they reach over the 60s as a rule. They become quite small, as if they're being carried away funicularly. They don't just stoop, they actually become smaller. And it's because as their interest in the external world fails, so less and less and less is put into their body to maintain it. And if they didn't actually become diseased, they'd become quite tiny, and logically would just go like that and cease to be. Usually they get knocked out with a disease. But if one of those persons is stimulated by some external demand on their energies, say by the sudden appearance of some quintuplets grandchildren or something, then new energy comes in, we call it a new niche of life. And as it comes in, the body begins to grow again. Those same elements that were taken out can be put back. But in general, there's a movement towards the grave because interest tends to fail. So if we look at these centers again, we see the feeling center is here. We're going to write the Amen in here. That's R, that's M, and that's N. We don't use the vowels in the Egyptian from which this word is borrowed. The Amen is the Aleph, which is that letter, the transcendent force. The M is the primary substance, and the N is the formulation of that substance. So when we finish a prayer and say Amen, it's really intended to remind us, first, primary power, second, substantialization, third, formulation. So we should say Amen. You should make it a habit of rinsing yourself in the bath when doing that. And your final rinse, throw a bit on there and say R, throw some on there and say M, throw some on there and say N. It's a good mnemonic. Anything will do to remind yourself. But actually, the field energy here is the originating one. And it's for this reason that we will never begin to work on a thing unless we feel like it. It doesn't matter how many people have how many good ideas outside us about why we should do certain things. If we don't feel like it, we don't do it. There are methods of making people feel like it by applying shock tactics or giving them chocolates and so on. But if they don't feel like it, they're not going to do it. If they feel like it, the first thing they do is begin to concentrate. And concentration is the same thing as the production of the primary substance. And then, producing the primary substance, if they're not interfered with, they then begin to modulate that substance and produce form within it. So the creative process is always in the same way, from an undefined feeling to the tendency to put your arms around the situation. The German word umarmen is a good word for that. It exactly expresses itself. Means about to round. So to umarm is put your arms around something. And when you umarm a situation, you have circumscribed a zone in which your feeling now begins to turbulate and finite and formulate. Every idea we have is a product of a feeling that we once had, putting its arms around a situation and then applying its energy within that field. And the result is always formulation. The mode of inventing is always the same. First you must feel like inventing, and you must feel the situation. Then you get a substantialization. At the lowest material level, you would say, I'm going to make it in plastic, or I'm going to make it in metal, and so on. And then you begin to formulate on that basis and lift it from there to there. So that's one, two, three. And one is the primary unity, two is the possibility of division, and three is the integration. And the integration presupposes the prior unity in which appeared the duality. So the one plus two is three. So this field plus that substance produces that form. And this field is infinite, but in the case of a finite human being, can be defined by him or by his educators. If it's defined by your educators, and they are dead educators, then you have a lot of inertias to overcome. But if you work upon it and redefine it and say, this edge is porous, and I accept through my porous membrane that forces come from outside and enter me, and I will determine their substantialization and formulation. So the general drift is from a feeling attitude towards the intake of foods, which are put down there, towards differentiation of those foods, and then the resultants lifted up there as thought. The whole organism then acts onto the environment in order to introduce the forms it has fabricated out of its substance into the environment. It is then doing exactly the same thing that God the Father is doing with its substance and putting new forms in. The only difference being that God the Father works with inside himself only, because there is no outside, and the human being works inside himself and outside. So a human being, as to his working inside, is exactly identical with God, and as to his working outside, he's doing a different kind of work from the work God does. And it is this working on the outside to alter it, that is the express reason why man was created. God created man in order that man might subdue the earth. You see, there was, before the precipitation of the gross material, another finer material. And the precipitation of the gross material was what was called the fall, or the covering up of potentialities, the fall. And all the potentialities locked in the material world have to be reclaimed and released in proper order. And as there were two impulses locked up in the earth, so two will have to come out of it. There was the prior stage of this, the absolute love, then the creation of a boundary, then the determination of this bounded being to be finite, then the precipitation of the material, and it's becoming gross, and in the process of the precipitation, it dragged in with it for the forces. So you find Milton saying that proud Lucifer dragged down with him one third of the heavenly hosts. Now in each centre of precipitation, there are many watchers who don't want to precipitate anything, and just hanging about the edge of the digging, not noticing that the men are digging nearer and nearer to their feet. And quite suddenly they all fall in. Now all those who fell in and were only watching and didn't initiate the determination to finity are called sheep. But all those that did initiate the finiting are called goats. So inside the precipitated gross material there are two kinds of impulses. Goat impulses, finiting, and sheep impulses, prepared to follow back the Christ figure into the absolute service again. And it says that there will be a separation of the goats from the sheep, and the goats will be moved from one side to another side, and the sheep will be moved from that side to this side, and then the goats will have to go where they belong, where they like finiting and fighting and so on. And these are dialectical processes within the substance itself once it has been formulated. The goats are the origin of all the forces in the mineral world and in the plant world and in the animal world and in man, who is absorbing them all, that make for further finitings, which is the same as positive negations, further prodigalities. And the sheep are all those that were just watching. Now if you look inside yourself, you will find these two aspects: the tendency to follow God sometimes, and the tendency to be a goat some other times. Now they're different impulses, and the fact that you can see both proves that you are neither. So you have to define yourself. It is the job for the human being to define himself. If he defines himself as a sheep, then he will go calmly following the law. If he defines himself as a goat, he'll have a further bash at finiting himself. Now there's obviously a great secret in this. This is the strong meat that Paul is talking about. It's Nietzsche's dynamite. Are you prepared to be a goat, or do you want to be a sheep already? Depends how hard you've been knocked. Now if you become a sheep too soon, well, you'll be a sheep too soon. You'll be very quiet, and if you wait a bit, you might be a stronger sheep. And it is said of the very, very strong sheep that when a wolf came on one occasion into the flock, the herdsman, who happened to be a rabbi, got the strongest sheep he'd got and gave it to the wolf, and while the wolf was trying to throw it on the ground, he took the rest of the flock away into a safe place, and then he came back and rescued the strong sheep which was still fighting the wolf. And so ultimately the wolf got none. This wolf is the universal appetite. If you read in the Act 1, Scene 3 of Taurus and Cressida, you'll see the universal appetite is defined as the origin of the hierarchy of the universe. This is the wolf. Now the strong sheep is this big one, and all the little sheep are inside here. Each one thinks it's a goat some of the time, and it wants its own way. When it gets badly knocked, it thinks it's a sheep. So human beings are continuously wondering how to define themselves. And this absolute spirit is only concerned with making reflexively self-conscious, cooperative individuals. So how you define yourself is the determinant of what kind of reward you'll get for your definition. If you define yourself as ultimately stupid, well then you get the reward of that. If you define yourself as stupid so far, you get the reward of that. If you actually defined yourself as pretty smart and able to calculate the last trump, and you were going to reform 2 minutes before it, and your calculation was correct, it would be all right with God. It'd be more likely he'd blow the trumpet 3 seconds earlier than you. Just for fun. The point is, man is a being capable of developing free initiative. Some people have the beginnings of it, some people show very little sign of it. Every human being has that potential. This is why Lewis Carroll said they are Lugians, not snobs. Snarks means negated beings. Pujams means the beings that are potentially divine. So every human being is potentially divine, potentially reflexively self-conscious, able to divine his own purposes. And he will always operate on the same law that the universe operates, because if he doesn't, he knows he'll come unstuck. So he knows which side he's bread buttered on ultimately. So the important thing about that is to recognize that it's upon our own concept that our feeling will precipitate. So how we think about ourselves causes our field to formulate around it and then to precipitate itself into activity, and so we sow the seeds of our own reward or destruction. The process is always the same, from the A to the M, then to the N. Now there's a question here about the in discussion, I can feel the consciousness in the forehead, and when walking there is not this concentration, and the mind seems to start to play through memories and fantasies. You know, quite a lot of writers and so on have said that they get good ideas walking rather than sitting down. And the reason is, of course, that when you're walking, the energy drifts into the centres of the lower part of the body. You know that your thighs are connected, there's only one bone in them, like your upper arm, they're connected with this prime five. You often get people with thigh trouble and trouble around the great country and so on, which has to do with prime drive. When you're walking, you're actually stimulating that prime drive part of yourself, and therefore the intellectual control center is being temporarily starved. And in that starvation is the possibility of fantasy rising up. In other words, you're going back into this partially defined feeling state in which you can get quite a few good ideas. They still have to be worked upon later on at the desk. But it's quite a good method of freeing yourself to walk and thus distribute the energies in your body away from the already formed center. Remember that fantasy is really the play of this stuff not yet turned round. When it is turned round, it becomes a defined system and becomes merely mechanical. We know there is a formula for writing an Edgar Wallace detective story. If that formula is examined, it's a very, very simple one. It consists of starting an incident at the end of that chapter, leading it, and starting another incident in the middle of the first one. Now, once you've seen the idea of it, it is quite mechanical. If you don't introduce some element of fantasy that is in definition into it, it is a merely mechanical structure, and people won't like it. So no matter how rigid your underlying structure is in writing a novel or playing your life, a little bit of indefinition in between helps to oil the works. So if a man were to give a perfectly logical and mathematical analysis of universal formal relations, nobody would listen. But if he formulated the same thing and in between he put rude stories as illustrative of it, then it would all go in. By rude, I mean rudimentary.
I just stick one thing in there.
Yes.
I've tried that, you know, and if you try to think as you're walking, you'll stop. An idea strikes, you'll stop then.
Well, of course, because you've shifted the...
Somebody else remembers something.
Yes. Then you spontaneously halt when something hits this part of the brain. You see, this part of the brain is concerned with the distribution of energies for the legs and for all the parts of the lower body, which has to do with these simple reflexes like an object. And walking is largely a reflex action as far as we are concerned. We just put the body out of equilibrium, sloping forward, and we start to fall. And quite spontaneously. And if you manage to be full of compassion while pushing them around, and clearly saying what is, the compassion is the same thing to them as an anaesthetic in a surgical operation. Tolstoy discovered that. that a person will accept a truth that hurts only if you feel compassion for them. And it isn't very, very easy to do those things at once. Is it Pfeiffer who did a drawing of Smiler recently? He's the only observer.
I haven't seen it yet, right there, either.
Did you see that? If you get these three parts operating simultaneously in full consciousness, then you are really being human at that moment. And to keep it up raises your temperature. Because initially you have to fly about from your centres. In a matter of split seconds you have to watch your urge, keep it pushing, feel compassion for the whole universe, clarify the mind, and back again, you see? Now it's a terrifically overheating exercise.
You become exhausted, isn't
it? No, you don't. The funny thing about it is you don't become exhausted. What's happening to you when you're doing that is you're being purified. Funny enough, the moment you use consciousness to do an act, in that way, and you're flying about the body, you become overheated, and you find, not that you are becoming tired, but that there are certain obstacles there that have to be overcome. But simultaneously, with the overcoming of them, if it's only for a few seconds, comes an awareness in you that power came into you to overcome it. Which is the meaning of the statement, we are never tried more than power will be given to us to deal with the situation. If you put that concept into your mind and keep it there, that you will never in the whole of your life be tried beyond your endurance. It is tremendously useful. Because if you don't believe that, then when you're being tried only a little bit, you'll think it's too much. You will define it as beyond your powers, and it isn't. If you think about the whole logic of the progression from here into the universal soul, and then into the sub-cycles, producing ultimately reflexively self-conscious beings, and always by the same method, that is to say, by an influx of infinite power into a closed situation, it is that power that formulates within you if you let it. So you can't be exhausted. But if you think you are doing it yourself as a finite, you have defined yourself as a battery, and you will define yourself as needing recharging in me. This is the meaning of the T in egotism, as opposed to egoism as a principle. Egotism simply means defining yourself as a finite container of finite energies and working in a certain way until in the end you say, I've had enough. And your definition determines the point to which you will go and stop. So you can see the tremendous importance of definition. As you conceive yourself to be in your feeling, as you think in your heart, so you must become. Your field is simply that part of the absolute field defined by your activities. As you are thinking about yourself in a certain way, you are circumscribing yourself. You are tying a rope around your own neck, or you are untying one. Your own definitions are continuously finiting your energies and tying them up into little bundles. You know, Nietzsche could say, through his psychological penetration of this fact, that the fact that people had no bad habits officially in his day was the indication of colossal wars to come. He prophesied them because he knew people were bottling up fundamental aggressions instead of talking them out. If those things had been made conscious, and if it had been said by the super Junkers and the Prussian warlords and so on, we all come from one spirit, and that spirit will never allow any finite to dictate to the whole, then we won't try because we can't succeed. Let us therefore talk with the other Junkers in other lands, because nobody can win. If they had said that, then a series of wars would not have been precipitated. They haven't said it, and they're still not saying it. Therefore, we know that these wars are going to come. They're still defining themselves as lords of the world, They still postulate that this spirit is an intelligent force. They admit it exists. They simply say it is unintelligent. It is true there is an absolute force, and they say we can control it. They ignore the fact that it produces them, and that you can't get out more than was put in. And so they say, although the absolute force is prior to our existence, yet we are the crown of creation, and creation did not proceed by fiat. No intelligence said, let there be, but everything evolved through a fortuitous concourse of atoms and accidentally produced myself, intelligence. And I am now going to seize the government of the world. Now this is their philosophy. The unintelligent forces accidentally produce configurations called human beings. Right, rule. That's a fundamental error. It ignores the fact that all these membranes are porous, that all finite is simply rotation of power, that all power is fundamentally not discontinuous, and therefore no power is isolated. And therefore, no power, finite, can be conceived able to rule infinity. Infinity feeds them all. If the warlords saw that, then they would abandon it and talk over the table. They are not going to do so.
Good night, Mr. Neal. Good night.